Welcome to the CRE Exchange podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in this space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of the CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research at Altus Group. I'm joined by Omar Eltaray, our Senior Director of Research. Together, we'll share the latest news and trends in the U.S. commercial real estate market. Omar, it's great to be with you for the first episode of 2026. So to get us started, why don't you maybe share with us a stat and then run us through our agenda for the rest of the stuff we're going to talk about.
Perfect. So 35 basis points. That's the stat of the day. And that's the average decline in all-in senior financing costs for commercial real estate lending. And the change from Q4 2025 over Q3 2025. This is really based on our recently conducted fourth quarter U.S. debt capital market survey, which our research team and the Altus Valuation Advisory Team conducts each quarter. In this survey, we collected over 1,500 quotes from active borrowers and lenders, so it's a pretty robust data set. The largest quarter of a quarter spread compression was seen in the senior short product category, where all-in rates of financing fell by an average of 50 basis points, particularly for that higher LTV fixed and floating rate loan bucket. Now, what's really notable here is that the average benchmark yield declined by about 15 basis points. The range was really 13 to 16 basis points during the quarter over quarter period from Q3 to Q4. But the lending rates came down further, 35 basis points. And this is really a sign of spread compression being real and being seen throughout commercial real estate. And I think that this is laying an excellent kind of foundation for the year ahead. And I think is something that we'll continue watching going forward. But for more about that data point in the survey, check out the show notes. But we'll hop into the regular agenda, which is pretty packed. We got a number of econ releases, including some labor data, Atlanta Fed's GDP Now, as well as some service purchasing managers indices. We have a bunch of housing data, building permits, and starts. And then we did get some recent consumer data, consumer credit, and sentiment. But also, we're just into the start of 26, and there's been a lot of news and attention on policy, both at the local level. We'll highlight some New York news, but then also at the national level that's really drumming up some pretty fierce debates. And we'll close the call out with, as we usually do, with some upcoming releases and other announcements. But Cole, why don't you kick it off on the econ front and let us know what you were seeing in terms of labor data?
Yeah, so there was a lot of labor data that came out at this point last week, and so happy to go through some of that. But we had three of them. The Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey that covered November 2025. Then we had the ADP National Employment Report for December. That usually precedes the employment report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics by a couple of days. So to kind of run us through some of those releases, JOLTS is a product of BLS. That was released on January 7th. And showed that total non-farm job openings actually didn't change very much on the month, but they were down quite a bit on the year, 885,000 from November 2024. The job openings rate was at 4.3%. In November, total hires were about 5.1 million, total separations also around 5.1 million, and quits at 3.2 million, layoffs and discharges at about 1.7. All of those were broadly stable on the month. Now, fast forward just a bit to the ADP National Employment Report. This came out slightly later in the day on January 7th as well. And that tracks private sector employment. It increased by 41,000 jobs in December. And that was a rebound from a revised 29,000 job loss in November. In that report, they found that annual pay growth for job stayers was about 4.4% on the year. For job changers, it was about 6.6%. So that was an acceleration when compared with November. But the really big release, and this is the big market mover, was the December employment report from BLS. This is the December report, was released on January 9th, showed that employers added only 50,000 jobs. That was well below expectations. That was marking another month of pretty sluggish hiring to close out a fairly weak 2025. So there was only a modest gain, but what's interesting is that the unemployment rate actually ticked down to 4.4%. That was slightly better than forecasts. So fairly stable labor market, even as hiring momentum has slowed pretty substantially. Gains were concentrated in sectors like healthcare and hospitality. We saw declines or only small gains in industries like retail, manufacturing, construction. So there were some revisions in this report as well to prior month's data. Total number of jobs added was trimmed. 2025 is actually the slowest annual job growth year in many years, I think since 2003, outside of recessions. So if you take this together, JOLTS, ADP, the BLS employment report for December, I've used this phrase a lot. You've seen other economists use this phrase. It looks like the labor market is cooling but not breaking. Job openings and hiring have slowed meaningfully over the last year, but layoffs and quits have remained pretty contained. So firms are scaling back hiring, but they're not cutting staff outright. So wage growth still fairly strong, definitely the case for job changers, but that is moderating. So for the broader economy, you know, you're really supporting that soft landing narrative. Growth is losing momentum. Labor-driven inflation pressures are easing. And so I think this does still strengthen the case for eventual Fed rate cuts in 2026, even as policymakers remain cautious. But for commercial real estate, you have a couple of either direct or indirect implications here. So slower demand growth rather than sharp deterioration. Softer hiring, professional services, retail, manufacturing, construction, some of those sectors I called out before. That's going to weigh on leasing and tenant expansion. But gains in healthcare and hospitality, they'll only partially offset, I think, some of those demand pressures. At the same time, I think absent widespread layoffs, there's not too much downside risk to occupancy for CRE, particularly in multifamily or necessity-based retail. From a capital markets perspective, though, cooling labor market does support the case for lowering rates, for borrowing costs to come down over time. And we're really waiting on that to help unlock some stalled refinancings and transaction activity. But a lot of labor data there. Omar, one other stat we got this week. How about you tell us about GDP now?
Yeah, so updated on the 9th. The Atlanta Fed's GDP Now model now casts real GDP growth at 5.1%. This is a seasonally adjusted annual rate for the fourth quarter. This is down slightly from the 5.4% a day prior. And that downward revision was really driven by weaker recent data that flowed in and was considered on the Friday print, notably a reduction in residential investment growth following some relatively weak labor and trade data. Now, despite this, the moderation from what I would say is extremely robust now casted growth at that 5.4% to this still above 5. It's important to recognize that the nowcast is still showing a pretty substantial above trend growth trajectory for the economy as a whole to close out 2025. Now, the elevated kind of growth rate contrasted by various data points that we've seen over the last month, but I think this is a sign of just the variability or volatility of data. And really, it depends on where you're looking to try to make sense of all of this. But overall, current nowcast is still showing this kind of above trend economic growth for the fourth quarter of 25. And I think this is fueling much of the optimism and the bullish case that we've had heading into 26. Connecting this to commercial real estate, I think that this is pretty clear to most of the listeners on this call that strong growth and economic activity is ultimately supporting greater demand for commercial real estate. I think that with the most recent nowcast, this kind of softer residential data could be reflective of soft housing construction and softer property turnover, which that factors into all of like the residential sector and subsectors for commercial. But overall, the robust GDP growth does support drivers, whether you're looking at consumer spending and overall business activity, which stands to benefit many of the other sectors, including office, as well as retail, industrial, et cetera. I think that that's one of the kind of big metrics that we'll continue to watch because it is still at this abnormally high growth rate. But we also got some of the service PMIs or the purchasing manager indices earlier this week. Both the services PMIs were released from S&P as well as ISM, and both were showing signs of ongoing expansion through December. Released on January 6th, the S&P Global U.S. Services PMI registered 52.5 in December, albeit at a slower pace of growth than in prior months and slower than initially forecasted or the consensus forecast. The next day, so on the 7th, the ISM released their services PMI, which rose to 54.4% in December, again marking this expansion for the service sector. And this was the third consecutive month of expansion and really suggesting that service sector activity strengthened in late 2025. The ISM and S&P, while they're both showing kind of expansion within the service sector, one is showing it at a slowing pace, whereas the other is showing it at an accelerating pace. Both of these metrics really do cover similar areas of the economy, but they do differ in terms of how they're calculated and their sector coverage. So getting those kind of cross signals is not entirely abnormal. But I think what you can do with the recent release is focus on what they're saying and it validating each other. And that is that the service sector is expanding. Again, you can tie this back to commercial real estate, where ultimately seeing a pickup that's going to be a benefit across sectors. But tying it to something a little bit more tangible and some of the recent housing data, Cole, do you want to cover building permits and housing starts?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a report we've been waiting on for some time. So we finally got new residential construction data for October 2025, and this came out on January 9th. So the overall story here is continued moderation in housing activity. And this was really driven, at least in this particular report, by multifamily. So the total number of building permits declined 1.5% on the month to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 1.4 million. That was about 3% lower than a year earlier. But multifamily permits fell much more sharply, down 4% on the month and more than 10% year over year to just over 480,000. Housing starts dropped a huge amount on the month as well, 4.3% to approximately 1.25 million. Multifamily starts were down 8% to roughly 350,000. But what's interesting is that completions are still relatively elevated, but they've now begun to slip. So 1.8% on the month to 1.39 million units, but multifamily completions were near 365,000. That's actually still up modestly from a year ago. So a lot of those projects that were started in the previous cycle continue to deliver it in this cycle. Now, there's a big pullback in multifamily permits and starts. That's a sign of future kind of weakness in the pipeline in overall residential investment. And interestingly, that's going to be a bit of a drag on GDP, even though we see the expectations are broadly elevated due to other parts of the economy. So you have tighter credit conditions than in that 2021-2022 portion of the cycle. 2026 is going to be a much slower time for new projects. So those elevated completions are, again, reflecting momentum from the prior development period, a decision-making period, rather than renewed confidence in this one. And I think for CRE more specifically, or for folks who tune in regularly, what you're seeing now is that the supply cycle is turning from multifamily. Near-term deliveries are definitely going to continue to pressure rents in some of these heavily built markets, but the sharp slowdown in starts. And that data can be fairly volatile, but even if you look at the sharp turndown in permits, that pipeline's thinning very quickly. So as the wave moves through, I think fundamentals in that market are going to gradually rebalance. So it's going to improve, I think, the medium-term outlook for rents, occupancy, and values for multifamily in areas where demand remains pretty resilient. But one other piece of the economy, Omar, that we haven't talked about in a bit, we got some consumer data. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, so the short of it was really not much. We did get 2 points in the first week of January, the first being the November G19 consumer credit data. This was released by the Federal Reserve on January 8th, and it showed that household credit growth continued through November. Total outstanding consumer credit rose at a 1% annual rate. That was driven by a 2% growth in non-revolving. Think of that as predominantly auto and student loan balances, while revolving, so pretty much credit cards, declined by 1.9%. The average interest rate saw some minor adjustments in terms of different loan products, and those did come down slightly, but that was expected as we've had rate cuts flow through the whole kind of credit universe. But another data point that we got was on January 9th. This was the preliminary University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index, and the overall index rose modestly to 54 for January. That's up from December's final print of 52.9, indicating a slight improvement in consumer confidence. Now, despite this uptick, sentiment remains significantly below year-ago levels and is still like historically low, reflecting ongoing consumer concerns around inflation, labor market, and financial uncertainty. Now, both the current conditions and expectations sub-indices improved, but again, remain well below long-run averages. Now, if you take these two data sets together, so the G19 and the University of Michigan releases, they showed really only marginal change in the consumer picture at the end of 25, because you got to remember that G19 is looking at November and the start of 26, because UMichigan is that preliminary read for January. I'm really curious to see the December data in the next G19 update. Consumers are still spending, just not as rapidly as before, and sentiment is still down. So one of the most notable things that stuck out to me was the special call out that the University of Michigan included in their release. And that was a chart and data around kind of job loss likelihood or expectations of job loss likelihood amongst different segments of the consumers surveyed. So they looked at those with bachelor's degrees or higher versus those without bachelor's degrees. And they show that the kind of higher degreed individuals have a greater fear of losing their jobs in the future. So that's something to me that is worth paying attention to, because I think that's an indirect kind of proxy and definitely is influenced by the broad economy, but also potentially by AI and the adoption of AI and the concerns around displacing jobs. And the reason why I think that this is interesting to watch is because after going through so many outlooks from asset managers, investment managers, banks, etc., one of the clearest themes heading into 26 is, if not the dominant theme, is AI and the adoption, and whether it's bubble risk or if we're going to start seeing this come to fruition. So seeing that play out in other sets of data, I think it is huge. But now leaving the econ data side, and we can, I guess, stick on the same theme of trends that will likely recur and drive 26. The first full week of January was also filled with a lot of media headlines and a lot of media coverage around housing, particularly housing policy. This is going to be a huge theme through 26. We've seen it at the local level here in New York, but then also nationally. Again, I think that this is setting the stage for what's to come in 26, as this will be one of the main media mentions or media drivers, as well as national and local debates as we head into midterm elections. So just to give a quick update on some of those key pieces that jumped out to us, we'll start with New York. New York City's new mayor, Zohran Mamdani, signed 3 housing-focused executive orders on his first day in office. And those included revitalizing and expanding the mayor's office to protect tenants, or MOPT. I haven't heard that one said, but M-O-P-T or MOPT. And creating 2 new housing task forces to drive production and cut red tape across the New York City development landscape. So the mayor's office to protect tenants, MOPT, was revamped and is explicitly framed as a citywide enforcement and tenant support hub, consolidating outreach, legal navigation, and coordination with HPD and DOB to respond to harassment, illegal evictions, and building neglect. Then the second task force that was set up is the Land Inventory Fast Track, or cooler acronym of LIFT. And that task force is really charged with reviewing city-owned properties and identifying sites suitable for housing development by July 1st, 2026. So we'll see if they can hit that deadline, with an explicit mandate to, quote, leverage city-owned land to accelerate housing development, increase supply, and drive down costs. I'm curious to see this one because I think for developers, it will potentially set up a pipeline for RFP-type opportunities on public land. And if it's successful, we may see some more cranes going up in New York and some new supply coming down the pipe. But then the third and final task force is the SPEED Task Force, which stands for Streamlining Procedures to Expedite Equitable Development. And that group is tasked with identifying and removing permitting and bureaucratic barriers that slow projects and increase costs. I think it's a headache for many developers all over the country, but particularly in New York. And if implemented, the intent is to really shorten entitlement and permitting timelines, particularly for those projects that really align with the administration priorities, which that's affordable. You can double, triple underline that. That is near transit and or on public land. But that's like very much from a New York perspective and just an example of some of the kind of local initiatives or policy shifts and movement that is happening here in New York. But I think we'll start seeing that nationally. But we also had some pretty big kind of like national news or announcements made and that also affected housing. Cole, what were those?
Yeah, so this was a proposal that President Trump made on January 7th. We don't have too many details, so we don't have to speculate very much. But he did post on his Truth Social account that he is immediately taking steps to ban large institutional investors from buying more single-family homes. So, you know, read that as some of your large asset managers, private equity companies, single-family REITs. But he also said in that announcement he wants to call on Congress to codify the ban into law. Says this is part of his broader push to make home ownership more affordable and accessible. Argued that corporate buying hurts the kind of, quote, everyday buyer. The quote in his post was that people live in homes, not corporations. We didn't get much more than that. He said that he plans to expand on this and other housing policies, at least at the national level, at the World Economic Forum in Davos later this month. But at this point, that's effectively all we know about this idea. A lot of details are unresolved or unclear. What exactly is being banned? We don't know what qualifies as a large institution. Is it based on AUM, number of homes owned, legal structure, or something else? Would the ban only apply to secondary market purchases? Would it apply to build-to-rent? And frankly, would such a ban even be legally or practically enforceable? We don't have answers to a lot of those. So directive's pretty vague. It will require congressional legislation and some specific rules. We got a little bit of clarity from Treasury officials in the days following. They said the proposed policy would not force institutional owners to immediately divest from existing holdings, only bar them from future purchases. And then there was an interesting clip from FHFA Director Bill Pulte. He appeared on CNBC on January 8th, said the ban would also apply to new construction, meaning that home builders would not be able to pre-sell inventory to SFR companies or other institutions. So the bottom line here is we're still waiting on some of the other details. The market reaction to this was fairly mixed, even though you saw some of the big share price declines for some of the larger public SFR REITs, other owners. Share prices have slowly crept back up since. But there's been a lot of great data flowing around in response to this that has shown just how small institutional investors, however you might classify them, as a portion of owners of all single family homes, even if they've become more visible in some other Sunbelt cities. So there are many housing analysts out there that are skeptical that such a ban would materially move the needle on home prices, which is the president's stated intent. And they argue that supply constraints play a much bigger role. In fact, a lot of these analysts and myself think that this will likely result in less new home supply. But I think the thing for folks in our space to pay attention to in response to this announcement is that even though this is one announcement that is yet to be followed by any kind of actual policy proposal, it's injecting a layer of uncertainty in the SFR and BTR space. And strangely, this is one area where there's a lot of bipartisan support for such a ban, even if it's not going to move the needle on affordability. But I would expect to see some other kind of news on this front to come out in the coming weeks and months. So would tell people to keep an eye on this. But Omar, I know you wanted to mention maybe one other kind of national proposal here too.
Yeah, and again, it's not quite at the proposal level, but it was late in the week on Thursday the 8th. President Trump also announced that Fannie and Freddie would be buying $2 billion in mortgage bonds to ultimately improve the financing environment for Americans. And buying up more bonds was a common practice they did before the GFC. They've stayed well below their limits, and they still have roughly $200 billion in capacity to buy additional. Again, not so much color here, but I think this goes to just emphasizing that the White House is absolutely focused on affordability, is focused on housing. You know, this is another story that we'll continue to watch, because I think the agency involvement in the overall housing, U.S. housing landscape is critical, and you can't overstate it. It is significant, but was part of the flurry of housing related media coverage that came out in that the first full week of January.
Well, and I know that the bond market has already responded to this idea, even if it's only in the idea stage. I think the 30-year fixed rate mortgage average dropped below 6% for the first time in a couple years, seemingly overnight. They're expecting something to happen here, but so, Omar, we've got a bunch of other stuff coming up here. A lot of econ data and releases that are coming up in the next week. And so next time we talk with you guys, hopefully we'll have some data on small business optimism and the consumer price index, which will have come out on January 13th. On Wednesday the 14th, we'll see the releases for retail sales and the producer price index, in addition to existing home sale data from the National Association of Realtors. And then Thursday the 15th, the day you'll be hearing this, the Empire State Manufacturing Survey and the Philly Fed Manufacturing Survey. And then Friday, January 16th, we'll get data on industrial production. And then another short announcement on my end, I'm headed down to Miami for the CRE Finance Council's conference. So by the time you're hearing this, it will have wrapped up, but I'm excited to possibly see some of our listeners down there, and I'm looking forward to sharing some of my takeaways with you all in a future episode. Omar, I know you have an announcement as well.
Yeah, and a little bit further out on the calendar, Altus Connect is coming up. It will be April 13th to 15th at Terranea Resort in Palos Verdes, California. We'd love for you to join us there. If you're working in commercial real estate and trying to make sense of shifting market signals, changing fundamentals, and you just want to know where Altus is headed, this is really a great room to be in. And it's not just back-to-back presentations. No worry about that. There are expert-led breakouts built around decisions that firms are making right now, plus plenty of time to compare notes with peers and meet some new folks that you can add to your network. And if you're an Argus user, there are real hands-on values to the conference as well, including Argus Intelligence Training and the Solutions Cafe, where you can bring workflow questions and talk directly with specialists and the product team who will be in attendance. Bottom line, Connect is really designed around high-value networking and actionable discussions that you can leave with takeaways you can use right away. We'll drop the link in the show notes.
Excellent. Omar, I think that's all the time we've got today. But before we sign off, I want to encourage our listeners, if you like the show, we'd love it if you could rate it. Please give us 5 stars on Apple and Spotify. Leave us comments there as well. We'd be happy to read them. Or feel free to send us an email at altusresearch@altusgroup.com. We'd love to know what topics you've covered on the program. In the meantime, Omar, it's been a pleasure, and I look forward to speaking with you on another episode of CRE Exchange. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.